and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Today we have on the show with us again, Nancy Piercy, who's a fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture and a professor and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University, as well as editor-at-large of the Piercy Report. She is the author of the award-winning book, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, as well as other books. And today we have Nancy on the line with us to discuss some excerpts from her new book, Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. And we're going to discuss Darwin's robots when evolutionary materialists admit that their own worldview fails. So, Nancy, thank you so much for coming back on the show with us.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
So you talk about in your excerpt from your book how materialist philosophy reduces us to machines. How does materialist philosophy reduce human beings to mere machines?
Right. Well, this is the section of the book where we're talking about how to test worldviews against the real world. After all, that's the point of any philosophy or worldview, is to explain the world. And a practical test of any worldview is how well you can live it out. You know, worldviews are not meant to be just abstract constructions in the world of the mind. You know, they're supposed to be giving us an account of what this world is and how we live in it. So that's why it's so important to test an idea by saying, can people live it out consistently without doing violence to human nature? And I applied that to evolutionary thought. And what I found was, is it's just really fascinating that many prominent evolutionists actually acknowledge that their philosophy does not fit the real world. And here's an example. Galen Strawson, British philosopher. He says we're essentially machines, robots, and he goes so far as to claim that the impossibility of free will can be proved with complete certainty. But then I dug up an interview with him, and he says, I can't really live with this fact from day to day. Can you? So what's his reductionism? He says humans are just machines, we're material beings alone, but does it fit the real world? He admits that he himself can't live with his own worldview. And so I went looking for phrases like that. When people say, I can't really live it, no matter how much I think philosophically that this is true, when I take it into the real world, it doesn't work. And so many of these arguments do focus on free will because it's at the heart of what makes us distinctively human. There are so many things that are possible only if we have free will, not just things like moral responsibility, but creativity, all the arts and literature, love, robots don't love, reason itself, if our minds are programmed to accept an idea that it's not a rational decision. So here's another example. This is Marvin Minsky at MIT. And again, these are all leading thinkers. I'm not finding fringe figures. You know, these are leading figures who are shaping the way people think. Marvin Minsky, best known for his punchy phrase, the human brain is nothing but a 3-pound computer made of meat. Now, of course, computers don't have free will. So the implication is neither do we. But then he too says, we can't live with that. And here's his direct quote. He says, no matter that the physical world provides no room for freedom of will, that concept is essential to our models of the mental realm, so we cannot ever give it up. And then listen to this. He says, we're virtually forced to maintain that belief, the belief in free will, even though we know it's false. In other words, false according to his materialist worldview. So this is incredible cognitive dissonance. He's essentially saying my worldview, my materialist worldview, tells me that we're complex computers made of meat, and yet we can't live with that. What do people do when they run up against truths that they cannot ignore that don't fit in their worldview? I mean, ordinary people would say, you've just falsified your worldview, right? You say humans function, you know, they are a certain way, their nature is a certain way, they function a certain way, but you take it out into the world and they can't live it. You and I would say you've falsified your worldview.
Is it possible for a person to go a full day truly believing that they don't have free will and living consistently based upon that belief? I mean, can we even go a day not believing that we have free will?
Exactly. We're making choices from the moment we wake up in the morning. And in fact, one philosopher, John Searle, says, if someone doesn't believe in free will, then the next time they go to a restaurant, they should say, just bring me whatever the laws of nature have determined that I will get. And so he was trying to say, look, we can't even go to a restaurant without believing in free will. Another example is Edward Slingerland. And, you know, he calls himself a materialist and an evolutionist, says free will is an illusion, and says, at the same time, he says, no one can help acting and at some level really feeling that he or she is free. In fact, one subsection of one of his chapters is actually titled, We Are Robots, Designed Not to Believe That We Are Robots. And you say, wait a minute. First of all, designed? Where do you get the language of design? But secondly, why would evolution design us, quote unquote, not to believe we're robots when we really are? And the answer that many evolutionists will say, well, it just makes it easier for us to function. Natural selection has selected for the illusion because it's easier to control our environment if we believe that people want things and have goals and intentions. One example I read was, it's easier to explain Sally's behavior when she goes to the fridge if you think that she feels thirsty and wants a drink. But in fact, internal states like feeling and wanting do not exist. But it'd be much harder to explain it all in terms of the neurons firing in her brain. So evolution has selected for this shorthand of free will. But it's amazing how many evolutionists admit they can't really live that way. In fact, Slingerland goes on to say, this is one of those colorful passages. He said, look, the idea of people as just complex robots is both, in his words, bizarre and repugnant. He said that kind of extreme reductionism reduces people to robots, inspires in us a kind of emotional resistance and even revulsion. He goes on to say, look, if you don't feel that revulsion, then something's wrong with you. He said there may be people who can conceive of themselves and other people as though they were just mechanistic, biochemical machines. But we label such people psychopaths, he says, and we quite rightly try to identify them and put them away somewhere to protect the rest of us. So what can we say when someone urges us to adopt a view of humanity that he himself admits is bizarre and repugnant, that ought to inspire revulsion, that would justify us in labeling people psychopaths and locking them up? This is a radical contradiction between what his materialism is telling him and what his own experience is telling him.
Exactly. I feel like materialism is asking us to throw out 99% of what we experience and pretend that it doesn't exist. It's so anemic in trying to give an account of the human experience. It goes completely against common sense. You have to take everything you believe about how you operate, what we are, and how we live our lives 99% of the day, every day, and throw it out the window. So can materialism give any kind of a sensible account of the human experience?
Yeah, that's the tragedy, is the things that it tosses out are the things that make life worth living, the things that matter most, the things that are necessary for constructing a humane society, like freedom and moral ideals, and even loving your own children. Let me give you one more example. This is very poignant because, and when I teach it in the classroom, this is the example my students always remember the best. It's Rodney Brooks, who is a professor emeritus at MIT. And he wrote a book called Flesh and Machines, where he says a human being is nothing but a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting by the laws of physics and chemistry. Now, in ordinary life, he says, I know it's difficult to actually see people that way. But he writes, when I look at my children, I can, when I force myself, see that they are machines. Now, is that how he actually treats them? Of course not. In the next sentence, he says, that's not how I treat them. They have my unconditional love. And then he admits that love has no rational analysis in his materialist worldview, because robots don't love. So his philosophy is too limited to account for reality as he himself experiences it. And this is why this kind of reasoning is so powerful, because you're not coming up against somebody and saying, well, let me give you a case for what I believe. Instead, you're showing them they don't live within their own beliefs. Their own materialist view of the human person is too constricted, it's too limited, it's too reductionistic to account for their own experience. That I would say they are made in God's image.
try as they might, they can't deny what they really are. They can't change the fact that they are not the products of mindless evolution, that their minds are not just meat machines, and that they really were designed to fundamentally need love. So it's their worldview that is the problem, not their actual origins of what they really are.
That's right. And who they are just keeps breaking through. Even when their worldview says they're just a machine made in the image of matter, their experience keeps telling them, no, you're a human being made in the image of God. It keeps breaking through, even for those whose worldview denies it. And that's what's so fascinating. The case for a Christian view of the human person is so strong that you can make your case even by looking at non-Christians and the evolutionary materialists who are trying desperately to live by a different conception of human beings, and the experience keeps breaking through. And I would say this is what a worldview or a philosophy or a theory is meant to explain. It's meant to explain our actual experience. And so it does function as a way to falsify the worldview. If you take it out into the real world and you can't live it, and inherently you can't live it. It's not just that you didn't feel like it one day, but you inherently keep living out a contrary view of the human person. That should function as a falsification of the worldview.
Well, Nancy, this is a really profound conversation we're having. We're going to continue this conversation about how evolutionary materialism has to borrow so many aspects of its philosophy from Judeo-Christian religion, and how it's, as you put it, it's freeloading off of religion, and it cannot give a complete account of reality and the human experience without borrowing all these ideas. So we'll get to that in the next podcast, but this is just so profound to talk about how, at base, evolutionary materialism cannot give an account of love, the most basic human need, and just how anemic it is to explain the human experience. Thank you so much for this conversation, Nancy.
Thank you, Casey.
I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Nancy Piercy, and be sure to check out her new book where she discusses all of this in more detail, Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.